I'm Kevin Barrett. I do this show every Saturday night, same time, same channel, right here at republicbroadcasting.org. Tonight I'm going to be talking about one of those controversial subjects that it's pretty hard to talk about just about any place except for RBN and maybe its sister Patriot Networks. I'm talking about the role of the Israeli lobby in American political life. This is a topic that is off limits in polite society. It's a topic that got me into hot water even before I fell into the boiling water of 9/11 truth. I remember back, I don't know what this was, about 1998 or something, when I was still a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin. I wrote a letter to the editor of the local so-called alternative weekly, which is not all that alternative, unless you're interested in shopping for yuppie consumer culture items. But anyway, I wrote a letter criticizing Israeli treatment of Palestinians. Well, guess what? Some wealthy alumni immediately contacted the administration at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and lots of Israeli lobbyists were ringing the phone off the hook in my department. And due to all this pressure, the department called me into a special meeting with the chair and reprimanded me for writing a letter to the editor criticizing Israel. Now, this may seem bizarre, but it's I swear it's true. And the weirdest thing about it was the chair of the department told me that she and everybody else that she knew in the department absolutely agreed with my position on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but that she couldn't say it. She said she was afraid that she would lose her green card status and be deported. Here she is, a Ph.D. teaching at a major university with tenure, and she's afraid she's going to be deported if she opens her mouth about Israel. So she read me a letter of reprimand, and she admitted that she and everybody else in the department didn't believe a word of it. It was completely ridiculous. It didn't make any sense. And I had to just kind of sit there and nod and say, okay. And she explained that if they didn't reprimand me for writing a letter to the editor critical of Israel, they would risk losing funding because the wealthy alumni were leaning on the administration and the administration was leaning on the department. Well, this was an early education for me on the power of the Israeli lobby that can prevent graduate students from writing letters to the editor criticizing Israel. This is a little extreme. This was before 9/11, folks. This was before the Constitution was blown up along with the Twin Towers and Building 7. Even then, you couldn't write a letter to the editor without all hell breaking loose. So I've been around the block on this issue a few times. In my 9/11 truth work, I've actually gotten criticized from some people who don't think that I'm hard enough on the Zionists. In fact, I was called a Zionist agent by Daryl Bradford Smith, who said I should be arrested for working for the Mossad. And I've also been criticized from the other side. Wikipedia won't come out and call me an anti-Semite, but it kind of beats around the bush of that accusation. So it's a really hot topic, and a lot of people are afraid to even talk about it. But if you can't talk about this on RBN, where can you talk about it? So that's what we're going to be doing tonight, is talking about just how powerful is the Israeli lobby in the USA. I know it's not the first time that it's been brought up here on republicbroadcasting.org, but today we will be talking with one of the more informed experts on this topic. His name is Grant Smith. He's the author of Foreign Agents, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee from the 1963 Fulbright Hearings to the 2005 Espionage Scandal. And we'll pick that up where we left off when we come back in just a moment here on Truth Jihad Radio. Stay tuned. I'm Kevin Barrett, and today we're talking about the power of the Israeli lobby in the USA, a topic that is almost completely taboo in the mainstream, although it looks like the dam is maybe starting to crack around the edges there a little bit. Let me start out this with a quote from George Washington that is often brought up regarding this topic. "So likewise, a passionate attachment of one nation for another produces a variety of evils. Sympathy for the favorite nation, facilitating the illusion of an imaginary common interest in cases where no real common interest exists, and infusing into one the enmities of the other, betrays the former into a participation in the quarrels and wars of the latter without adequate inducement or justification." Well, my guest today, Grant Smith, thinks that that is the case with the Israeli lobby in general and the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee in particular. I'm sorry, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in particular, best known as AIPAC. He is one of the leading experts on this topic. He is the author of Foreign Agents, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal, as well as the earlier Deadly Dogma, how neoconservatives broke the law to deceive America. It's an honor to have on the show Grant Smith. Welcome, Grant. How are you?
Hello, Dr. Barrett. I'm just fine, and I hope you can put up with the sound of a barking beagle here and there, because it's one of the weekend shows, and that happens sometimes when you call from home, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. We have no problem with barking beagles. I mean, I believe in free speech. I'll pretty much let anybody make noise on this show.
All right. Well, I'll try and make my share as well.
All right, yeah. I noticed you're making the kind of noises that often create even larger noises. It's quite.
Well, we're trying. I mean, we're trying to take you mentioned some of your experiences and the breaking of the dam, but we've really tried to take a 360-degree look at the earliest formation of AIPAC in particular, and what it's been doing for Americans in general. And I think you're right in the dam being broken down. There seem to be about 20 or 30 books on Amazon that have not yet been published, all on this topic. And many of the people I contacted to review this book last year seem to be working on their own now. So I think we're going to get more than 360 degrees of perspective by the end of this year, actually.
Well, that's very good news, because, you know, it seems to me this is long overdue that this Israeli lobby has been getting away with murder, quite literally, over in Palestine for a very long time. What got you into this line of work? I know from experience that it's not necessarily the easiest, best paid kind of work.
No, you certainly don't get into this for the money. I think if you look at my bio, I've been doing research all my life. A lot of it in the corporate world, for doing market research. A lot of it doing international research in terms of looking at markets, market dynamics, regulation for investment in Latin America and in Europe. And when you bring a professional primary research approach to virtually any topic, where you simply say, we're starting from a blank sheet of paper, and we're going to look at an issue from every possible angle in a way that takes into consideration some of the negative consequences of what seems to be going on, but without any preconceptions, we're gonna take it all the way from where it started to the present day. You can really see a lot more than you can simply looking at popular recent media, looking at pundits and talking heads, or any of the mainstream media. So I think bringing a professional research approach can really unlock and clarify some things. And plus, this is a particularly challenging area because, number one, back in 2002, 2003, when I first became very interested in it, it was even more of a taboo than it is now, not that it isn't now, but, there's something attractive about, and it's not very logical, but there's something attractive to looking at a problem that has so much taboo and so much baggage tied to it.
Well, I agree. That's what drew me in originally, was not so much that I thought that the outrages being committed against the Palestinians with U.S. tax dollars were necessarily the most evil, the biggest evil going on the planet, although, mm-hmm. Argument could be made that they are, but I didn't think it was so much that. It's just that the level of taboo in American culture struck me as just bizarre. It made me want to find out more.
Right. If your experience, and I heard you in the lead on, your experience in academia, which is not at all uncommon, where you think that you're in a bastion of academic rigor and being able to ask the hard questions about virtually anything, and to encounter that wall and all of the different agencies with an interest in shutting you down, that's a big surprise for many in academia, and it's a bigger surprise for people who are used to speaking freely about virtually any issue to finally understand that their letter won't be published to the editor, that they can't stand up in the local meeting without violating someone's sensitivities. Or in the case of this recent event in Connecticut in a public library where Allison Weir was trying to give a presentation talking about comparative media treatment between Palestinian casualties and Israeli casualties, to actually have it be shut down before it then generates a groundswell of support and people actually attend in huge volumes. But people who haven't encountered that, I think, will be surprised that it's occurring in America, where by nature we assume that there is no taboo subject, that by nature we're pragmatists, we like to wrap our arms around problems, we like to speak freely about virtually everything and anything. It's very strange for Americans to encounter that firsthand.
Well, it certainly did seem strange to me to suddenly have the whole university going into an uproar because I published a letter to the editor, not even an academic journal. You know, what business should it be of the universities? It just that really got me wondering. And to be perfectly honest, it didn't make me want to shut up, and it didn't make me want to toe the Israeli line. Quite the opposite. I would think that some of this is counterproductive.
Yeah, I think it is, and a lot of this infrastructure that's been built with campus groups, with orthodoxy and a dogmatic approach, doctrinal approach to the region in Middle East studies, this has been carefully assembled, and we can get into some of this when we look at some of the internal documents that came out of the Fulbright hearings. But there's been a massive investment in the United States to put together an infrastructure that will demonize people, that will thwart rigorous academic and the promotion of academics who are uncovering new facts and new perspectives. And it's been put together over the last 40 years. So the fact that we run into it and many of us don't like it, I think, is it's not something new. It's been going on for quite a while, and we're running into an infrastructure that's been put in place to accomplish certain things, and we need to talk about it.
And your book, Foreign Agents, goes back into the history of AIPAC. It starts at this sort of foundational moment when AIPAC is just about to be set up, morphing from direct Israeli government money to becoming a so-called public interest lobby of American citizens. And Senator Fulbright was holding investigations on this. That was a pretty amazing moment in your book, I think, is really commendable, bringing that out.
Well, we went back into history, and believe me, there's a lot more history to be uncovered. I mean, in your work, you find that there's a lot of classified information you'd like to get your hands on. Believe me, there's just as much in terms of government perspectives, embassy and diplomatic cables, FBI subversive activity reports, all sorts of stuff that we don't have our hands on. But perhaps the most interesting place to start would be talking about Isaiah Kennan, who in the late 50s was putting together various groups, including AIPAC, and he made a decision, and this in his book Israel's Defense Line, which is kind of his end of career book talking about friends and foes in Washington. He makes it very clear that there was a certain point where, when he was talking to different funders and backers and ideological fellow travelers, when they were looking at the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which is the prime U.S. law put in place to regulate lobbies on behalf of foreign countries, where they made a very conscious decision saying we could do so much more if we don't comply with that law and simply go into stealth mode. I've got the book in front of me. I won't run to the page where he's going over that, but basically there was so much more to be done in putting together the lobbying infrastructure that could not be done in the broad light of day and registering with the Department of Justice, periodic reports saying, okay, we're bringing in this much money, we're putting this much money into propaganda and political activities. We're using this money to lobby Senator X, Y, and Z to accomplish certain objectives on the Hill. It was a very conscious moment where they said, no, we're not going to be doing this above board. We're going to go stealth. And the Fulbright hearings that occurred in the 60s dug into them quite a bit.
They sure did. Well, and we'll have to talk about how they did that when we come back after the break.
Okay.
Okay, Kevin Barrett here talking with Grant Smith, author of Foreign Agents. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to RepublicBroadcasting.org. This is Kevin Barrett doing Truth Jihad Radio every Saturday night. And today I'm talking with Grant Smith. He's the author of Foreign Agents, and he's also with the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. So, Grant, you're talking a little bit about the history of AIPAC and how they early on discovered that it was going to be a lot more effective to go stealth rather than registering as agents of a foreign power, as they are required
right.
to do by law.
Exactly. And the decision was key because, again, say I'm a lobbyist for Egypt. I have to bring the money in. I have to fill out a report with the Foreign Agents Registration Office at the Department of Justice down on New York Avenue in downtown D.C. and declare how I'm going to spend the money, what programs and propaganda I'm going to engage in, which Congress people and the administration officials I'm going to contact, and particularly if I'm doing any sort of coordination beyond that policy negotiations, I have to disclose that. What happened in the 60s is Senator Fulbright had read some articles by Walter Pincus, who's still with the Washington Post, in which he was talking about how although this law had been in place since 1938, and it was put in place because the Nazis had a huge propaganda effort through a certain PR firm, which we won't get into.
It wasn't Hill and Knowlton, was it?
No, it wasn't.
That's the Bush family firm that brought us the baby incubator hoax and so on.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. But very, probably not as professional as that, but as effective, probably. Well, not as effective, ultimately.
Definitely not. No, they didn't win that one.
But,
which is probably just as well.
Written a bunch of articles about the activities of sugar barons in Latin America and some West German lobbying and also the Israel lobbying activities which are taking place. And they started Senator Fulbright from Arkansas was very interested in this. He was on the Foreign Relations Committee. And he said, okay, Walter, you get a team together, start subpoenaing documents, and we're going to have hearings in 1963. And so through 62, Pincus was on the trail, and they did some of the other countries, but they also did the different Zionist organizations in New York, the American Zionist Committee, and they got a lot of internal documents, receipts, canceled checks, account books, executive reports to different directors about different activities. And he found that they found at least $5 million of activities and flows from Israel to the U.S. to launch different programs. They were very upset by the fact that certain U.S. diplomatic plans, such as the Johnson Plan, which is designed to finally solve the Palestinian refugee program by offering some the possibility to go back and reclaim their lands. Others would get a settlement, and others would be resettled under financing. They felt as though this lobby was front-running them by getting information about this plan, putting together stealth propaganda in Israeli and U.S. newspapers, and ultimately successfully getting the Johnson Plan to be completely unwound before it was even really underway. And this was something that Fulbright felt was in direct contravention to the Foreign Agents Registration Act. It was exactly the sort of thing that the FARA law was supposed to uncover and put to the light of day and ultimately prohibit, because if you're trying to do that sort of thing and openly filing reports about your activities, you tend not to do it, which is the whole point of FAR registration, that sunlight is a cleansing phenomenon. But at any rate, this led Fulbright to hold two separate days of hearings specifically on the Israel lobby in 1963. And what we've done in the first chapter of the book is really go through how some of the things that he uncovered, even things that didn't seem important or even innocuous at the time, were foreshadowing some major problems that were on the horizon that would continue as this lobby grew in its stealth mode across the United States.
Well, Fulbright caught them playing a shell game with money, didn't he? Where as soon as they heard that he was onto them, they immediately shifted from having this Israeli outfit, was it the World Jewish Congress or something, directly funding the American lobbying effort,
right,
to having them pay Mr. A, who then paid Mr. B, who then paid Mr. C, who then pretended to be selling subscriptions to a newsletter, and
right.
they kind of money laundered it.
Well, exactly. The term wasn't used then, but he basically found that Cy Cannon, who had formerly been registering under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, was now being paid by various, they called them conduits at this point. For example, he began a newsletter, I think it was in 1957, called the, 1957, the Near East Report, and he begun, instead of being paid directly a salary as a foreign agent, he dropped off the radar and was now being paid by the same agency for subscriptions so that he could send this out across the United States. None of this was declared on any registrations. And all sorts of other money was coming into foundations, at times foundations that didn't even know where the money was coming from because it had an intermediate step to fund think tanks and different activities. So it turned into a shell game rather quickly, and Fulbright was very angry about it.
And the shell game has been continuing to this day. We'll come back and talk some more about it in a moment. I'm Kevin Barrett talking with Grant Smith, author of Foreign Agents. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
I'm Kevin Barrett talking with Grant Smith, the author of Foreign Agents, and he's with the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. You know, Grant, this history that we're talking about has very real consequences for very real people. Just the other day was the news story headlined, Israeli Minister Threatens Holocaust. Deputy Defense Minister Matan Vilna threatened Gaza Strip Palestinians with a Holocaust, and this
right.
threat came the day after 31 Palestinians were killed in the Gaza Strip, which brings us up to more than 200 Palestinians killed since the Annapolis peace talks versus 5 Israelis. And this kind of carnage has really been going on and off ever since the events happened that you're talking about back in the early 60s.
Right, and from our perspective, it's been avoidable carnage. I mean, there have been so many attempted peace plans, which we feel have been thwarted illegally by domestic lobbies acting in coordination with different officials in Israel and different groups, that, if the Johnson plan had been put into place, or any of the earlier plans for actually settling the problems, which is a refugee problem, which is a repatriation problem, which is a compensation problem. There are enough good ideas, brains, and financial resources to have taken care of this 40 years ago.
That's right. If the Johnson plan had succeeded, that almost certainly would have meant lasting peace back, from early 60s on.
Right. And, this is something that many presidents and many State Department officials have been aware of. But again, this is part of the strategy. The strategy, and something that Isaiah Cannon said virtually right after, he said, we're not going the foreign agents route. We're going to go with a stealth domestic lobby, was that they had to go direct. They had to circumvent the State Department. They had to circumvent the United Nations. the very institution that brought them into being, and they had to make their appeals directly to Congress so that every single member of Congress had to feel pressure from their district, the kind of pressure that they respond to, which is potential donation cuts, same pressure your university felt, that there's not going to be funding for their reelection, that there's going to be a smear campaign against them, that they're going to be called horrible names, that was the avenue to power. Again, it's not an avenue that you can take and file monthly foreign agent registration reports on. It's a stealth mode that you have to go directly to Congress and pressure the administration as well.
And, of course, you'd think that the risk would be that by going into stealth mode and doing this kind of really dubious lobbying, that they would risk exposure. But for some reason, it seems like the mainstream media in the U.S. has absolutely no interest in exposing any of this.
Well, it used to. And that's some of the things that we've done in the book, Foreign Agents, is we published. There was a time back in the 60s, 70s, and partially into the 80s, where even the Washington Post published some leaked memos. Now, an organization like AIPAC is absolutely not supposed to get into partisan politics. It's a 501c4 organization, which means it's a nonprofit. It's tax exempt. And they're not supposed to be trying to get one candidate elected over the other. Washington Post published internal AIPAC memos showing that they were actually setting up political action committees across the United States and then directing money to certain candidates. This one dated September 30, 1986, that the Washington Post proudly put inside the paper, which shows that all of the claims of AIPAC up to that point, that they didn't get involved in partisan politics, are absolutely false, that they were running very intense efforts to knock out candidates and to direct funding to their favorite candidates on behalf of their foreign principal. So,
well, that's certainly not a secret, Grant. In fact, the notion that AIPAC has 501c4 status and isn't allowed to take sides for or against any candidate would seem like a sick joke to a whole lot of people, including, you know, Fulbright himself, who got knocked out of Congress, and lots of other people have too.
That didn't happen until later. I mean, they were aware of it, but this is getting to your point of the press doesn't have the stomach. The press did actually used to have a bit more stomach. In fact, there's a really interesting piece on antiwar.com today talking about, the article is called When Conservatives Love the Palestinians. Some of the reasons that this self-lobby had to get moving quickly is that they didn't have a lot of allies early on. And, in fact, this whole article talks about think tanks and major magazines and conservative thinkers who were really much more, in light of their fervent anti-communism, much more supportive of trying to develop relations with the Arab world and suspicious of, generally not friendly to Israel. And so, you know, in terms of uphill battles, early on there was quite a bit of press scrutiny of AIPAC. Early on, there's quite a bit of skepticism. You know, this even in 1970, the American Enterprise Institute, of all places, had a real debate on Middle East issues with real pro-Palestinian thinkers and real pro-Israel thinkers. They were actually, the question was still open at this point about what to do. And, you know, we've seen a lot of that shut down in the interim, and you and I may perhaps not remember reading about or seeing any of this on television, but it was actually occurring.
Right, yeah. Pretty much all I can remember from my entire adult life is this very strongly pro-Israeli biased situation, which I gradually became aware of and only gradually realized just how extreme it was.
Right. Well, and I think it's interesting to look at some of the subpoenaed documents talking about the media campaign and how, if anything unfavorable came out, that AIPAC and its the American Zionist Council, its predecessor, would have templates and specific tips for people to write localized letters to respond about early efforts to get together 16 PR experts in New York to begin, you know, framing issues and begin spreading different doctrine through major media organizations. You know, this thing, it took a long time to build, and it took a long time to make sure that, you know, organizations like the Brookings Institution and American Enterprise Institute and other so-called think tanks would stop thinking and begin towing the line. It's taken a lot of money. It's taken a lot of behind-the-scenes effort. And, you know, one of the things that's vastly bolstered this stealth lobby is the fact that we don't know much about it. There have been virtually no internal operatives stepping out into the light of day and writing the, you know, tell-all book.
And you wonder sort of why that is.
Because they have to sign confidentiality agreements. It would be the end of their financial life if they ever did that. Confidentiality agreements are not any sort of, you know, it's not something most people working for a major corporation, and certainly not a nonprofit,
right,
have to sign.
That's bizarre.
You don't have to sign a confidentiality agreement when you leave, you know, the university.
They would probably
encourage you to bring your knowledge base to your next appointment.
Right. It makes you wonder whether it's a nonprofit or a mafia.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've made that analogy before in Deadly Dogma about how neoconservatives act more like a mafia than they do any sort of political movement. But that's
right. I thought that was a good point.
It took a long
time to build this lobby, as you say. How long will it take to take it down? I know in your book you've called for it. You say 40 years after the Fulbright investigation, it's time to put an end to this illegal foreign lobby that has long flouted U.S. law and suborned the national interest as a foreign agent. That's the clarion call at the end of your book. Is that really possible?
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's something that we firmly believe in, and many other people do based on the evidence. I mean, I guess the most troubling thing that Fulbright found out when he lifted the corner of this lobby was that it was basically financed in the early years and put together by Jewish agency funds. Now, this is the big quasi-governmental unit in Israel that's responsible for financing colonization and all sorts of activities, some of them, you know, to bring in people to repay, well, to put them into place and get them up and running. But, you know, Fulbright had found out that this is the organization that was financing the American Zionist Council, that they're washing all this money into the U.S. to support their programs, putting together their lobby. And then, you know, suddenly the financial flow is reversing. You see that, you know, major newspapers such as USA Today and the Jewish Daily Forward suddenly broke the news that in the $50 billion that's gone toward illegal settlements, generating so much terrorism and instability in Palestinian territories, that the Jewish Agency was one of the board members and one of the executives or principal organizations involved in all of that, and U.S. tax-exempt funds were being, you know, basically the laundering, instead of coming in to the U.S. to manipulate our political and media, was actually flowing out and generating instability, including occupations, you know, grabbing Palestinian lands with no particular right or title. And this is, you know, something that Fulbright was onto, obviously. He didn't know that it would come to this, because, you know, at the point of his investigation, the money was coming into the U.S. as opposed to, you know, flowing out in such massive quantities. But I think it just goes to show that when you allow an organization to function in contravention of U.S. interests and U.S. laws, that this is what ultimately happens. This is the point that you arrive at where now the U.S. is put in peril. And of the few things in the 9/11 Commission report that you can actually probably hang a hat on, one is certainly the fact that a lot of the alleged terrorists, and, you know, there's a lot we don't know about it, but were motivated certainly by this injustice, and certainly other academics such as Pape in Chicago look at this occupation and the turmoil generated by it as being a major or leading cause for instability.
And tonight I'm talking with Grant Smith, who's the author of Foreign Agents, and also Deadly Dogma, How Neoconservatives Broke the Law to Deceive America. And Grant, in Deadly Dogma, more than in Foreign Agents, you talk about this crucial period later on in the 60s. You know, and Foreign Agents gives us a lot of detail on the Fulbright investigation of AIPAC at its very beginnings. And in Deadly Dogma, you talk a little bit about the 1967 war, which is often considered the real turning point in terms of the U.S. Getting completely on board with Israel. And, you know, people like Norm Finkelstein have made that argument that before 67, even the American Jewish community was not very passionate about this. And post 67, everybody loved the winner and they all jumped on board. In Deadly Right. Dogma, you talk about how this myth of the innocent Israeli defensive war was constructed in complete variance with the facts, which is that the war was very much a war that was planned ahead of time, a war of aggression. It was in no way a defensive war against, you know, protecting themselves against invasion.
Well, yeah, the interesting thing is, and this gets back to what we were just talking about, which is, you know, this is an event which occurred back in the 60s. We're only beginning to get the relevant NSA intercepts, declassification of documents, to get away from the mythology that's been constructed around the 67, you know, the Six-Day War, and begin to talk about what actually happened. And if you did a poll, and we did this, I was on Armstrong Williams' show in New York, and I said, well, you know, let's talk about the 67 war. You do know that, of course, Israel struck first. And Armstrong said, what are you talking about? Of course not. And then he gave me a list of the countries that attacked Israel preemptively. So there's not even a popular consciousness in this country about who hit first. And of course, you know, reading a lot of books, and again, I point to Israel's Defense Line by Cy Kinnon, there's nothing in there that talks about Israel striking first, which of course it did. But the most important thing were the classified Johnson administration transcripts, which were recently released, and I was at the State Department event where they released these, and you wouldn't believe the turmoil in the crowd and the different personalities that were there. But basically, the key information is the fact that the Egyptian envoy was trying very hard to wind this conflict down, contrary to a lot of different writings about it. He was on his way or going to be coming to the U.S. Hopefully to negotiate a standing down when, of course, Israel struck. And there's a lot of newly released classified information which is going to force a lot of older histories to be rewritten about, you know, the fact that Egypt was not very well position to launch any sort of strike. There's a lot of back-and-forth aggression leading up to this whole event, but it didn't have to happen. And this whole preemptive strike is at the forefront of the thinking of a lot of neoconservatives who hold preemption as just a central doctrine in their thinking about.
And, of course, that's just an excuse for wars of aggression, which is what Israel has been committing throughout its history.
Of course. Yeah, according to the thinkers, it works. And you do a little research and you find out a lot of times it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right, right. Well, we'll be back to pick this up when we come back. And people can call in here at 800-313-9443. That's 1-800-313-9443. To talk to Grant Smith, the author of Foreign Agents and Deadly Dogma, two of the best documented works on the U.S. Israel lobby. So we'll be back in a moment. Stick around.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
And Grant, I would like to talk a little more about the 1967 war, but we do have a caller. It's Carl from Montreal. So, Carl, what's up? You have a question? Hello, Carl. Carl? Going once, going twice.
Hello?
Oh, hey. Hi. Hi, Carl.
Hi. Just listening in what you guys are talking about with Israel and the, you know, as you know, while I'm a Christian believer, But I don't support the so-called Christians that we have in office, which a lot of them are dual Israeli citizens, and I do not support the dispensationalist Protestant eschatology, which they believe that the restoration of Israel is the restoration of Israel, which was promised in the Bible. I believe that there has been a false interpretation, and this false establishment has gotten into place and has fooled a lot of Christians into supporting Israel as the I don't know, you know, I know that's been mentioned on some other shows, but I'm one of those who believes in the Bible, but I believe that the God gave a covenant with Moses that was a conditional covenant. You know, as long as the Jews obeyed God, they were, you know, special people. You know, that's how I believe along that line. But I believe that, you know, something must be done and these people got to be run out of office in this Jewish lobby. I mean, somebody should stand up and speak out against what's happening, because I'm totally agree with your guest here today. So.
Well, thanks, Carl. And actually, now that you mention the Christian side of the Israel lobby, that's a kind of an interesting story in itself, Grant. Back in 19, you know, early 60s, when Fulbright was investigating proto-AIPAC, there wasn't really much of a Christian Israel lobby. And now we have a huge one. You know, they've taken over the Air Force. Is Mikey Weinstein, my upcoming guest on this show, I believe, has often said. He's with militaryreligiousfreedom.org, and you know, they're doing all sorts of outrageous things. This radical pro-Israel stuff, bringing in ex-Muslims to talk about how evil Islam is to the Air
right.
Force cadets and so on and so forth. How did we get to this point?
Well, it's definitely gotten out of hand, but your caller, I think he even kind of refuted his own point in that it's not a Jewish lobby. It's an Israel lobby, and it's got a lot of elements to it now. Back in the 60s, there was a really focused effort to get speakers into different Catholic churches and get them involved. With the Catholic Church in particular, and later other denominations and groups, so that they could spread the message and focus on putting together a common policy view of the world to grow and to have the sort of monolith that we see today. From the sidelines, it looks like probably the deadliest embrace in the history of politics, where you have a group of evangelicals who again believe in this dispensationalist view of how Israel's going to ultimately, Israelis have a choice between dying or converting. It's very, with John Hagee and other members of this political movement, it's something that I think observers on the sideline look at with incredible disbelief that it's even hanging together, and yet major administration figures look to this as being one of the central coalitions that's keeping them in power. In fact, probably one of the most interesting views of this is an administration official, Elliot Abrams, who sees this as being the perfect political matchup.
Right. Abrams loves it, and a lot of the rest of us have trepidation. We'll be back in a few moments. This is Kevin Barrett talking with Grant Smith, author of Foreign Agents. And hey, Grant, you know, there's this great book out there called Forcing God's Hand by Grace Halsell, and she describes going to Israel and going to Megiddo, which is the town that Armageddon is named after, and she's standing there on the hill of Megiddo with this American Christian extremist who's been brought over there with all his friends by our tax money funneled through Israel, and this guy's named Clyde, and she asks Clyde, do you really, she can't believe what he's saying. You really visualize Jesus as a five-star general opting for the use of nuclear weapons? And Clyde says, yes. In fact, we can expect that Christ will make the first strike.
preemption is in her mind as well.
That's right, preemption. Oh, boy. So this whole movement of the Israel lobby from its beginnings in the Jewish community, and actually probably a pretty small minority of the Jewish community, to this huge Christian fundamentalist apocalyptic, let's blow up the world, go ahead and, you know, launch that nuclear first strike, Jesus kind of thing, regardless of what Elliot Abrams might think, I think it's frightening.
Well, it is frightening, and you know, again, in the history, they had a hard time convincing a lot of people within the community to go along with this. In fact, there's in the subpoenaed documents of the Fulbright hearings constant appeals for funds because they need, you know, to kickstart fundraising in the U.S. These groups don't identify with them yet, and it took a lot of effort and money to put this together. But when you get to the point of not the person on the hill imagining the future coming battle, but when you look at someone like Elliot Abrams and this deadly alliance that he's embracing, again, he wrote a book called Faith or Fear before going into the Bush administration, and this is the key guy, the guy who's negotiating Middle East peace. But this is a man who writes about missing anti-Semitism as a cohesive force for his movement. He talks about how absent military calamity, you know, there's no cement anymore for holding Israel together. You know, he lays all of this out in his book, Faith or Fear. In other words, this is a guy who, at the core, his policy approves of conflict, and it embraces all this hateful ideology as a pillar of his own power base. So, you know, looking at the smaller groups and the atomized elements is interesting, but when you have someone who is thinking in this way at the pinnacle of power in the U.S., and this man is, if anyone, part of the Israel lobby family, part of the AIPAC family, the epitome of AIPAC, it just shows you how twisted and corrupt.
That's right. And of course, Abrams is linked with this neoconservative philosophical movement that agrees with this idea of whipping up hatred, lying to people, deceiving people, manipulating people in service of one's own power. Well, hey, we have a bunch of callers, so let's get to them. Tom is calling from Texas. Come in, Tom.
Hello.
Hey, hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to say I used to study the British Empire, and the British did a lot of wars of aggression to expand their empire. And if you read the textbooks on the British Empire, you'll find out that people like Winston Churchill were always saying that the British were uniquely ordained by God to be the ruling race over all humankind. And if you study what the Jewish rulers say for the past 40 years in Israel, they have been saying the same thing, that they are uniquely ordained by God to be the ruling race over all humankind, and that it's their manifest destiny.
Well, there's some Americans that seem to think that too.
Right. We also are the same way, and I noticed that we have a UN Security Council vote coming up Monday, and every time they're going to have one of these, they're always doing stuff before the vote to pressure Russia and China to backstab Iraq and Iran with this Security Council vote. And they did the Kosovo thing just a couple weeks ago, and then the Russian diplomat came out yesterday and said they're going to backstab Iran with their vote on Monday. And then I noticed that the United States House of Representatives introduced a bill to pressure Taiwan to declare independence just the other day in order to get the Chinese diplomats to backstab Iran with their UN Security Council vote. If you've been watching this over the years like I have, every time they're going to have a UN Security Council vote, before it happens, they're always threatening the Chinese to raise their tariffs on the Chinese products. Or right now, the House of Representatives have that bill to encourage Taiwan to declare independence to get the Chinese to backstab Iran. And I think this is going to happen on Monday. I think the Chinese are going to backstab Iran with their UN Security Council vote.
Well, Tom, do you think this is a case of fostering of conflict in pursuit of power, as Grant has been describing, the neocon Israel lobby people like Elliot Abrams actually trying to create conflict and danger for Israel, existential danger, in order to cement his own power base? Do you think they're doing that right now in this administration, fostering conflict in order to increase their own power?
Yeah, I do. And plus, I think they're trying to focus the world's attention on Iran developing nuclear weapons so that nobody ever talks about Israel having nuclear weapons and threatening to mass murder all the Arabs. If something doesn't go right for Israel, they'll just launch all the nuclear weapons and mass murder hundreds of millions of people.
That's an outrageous double standard, it seems to me at least. Grant, you didn't really discuss very much about this ridiculous double standard regarding the weapons of mass destruction in your books. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think Seymour Hirsch wrote the last book on the subject when he discussed it back in the, I think his book came out in 1982. He puts it as a way, he doesn't talk about the fact that Israel had to do a lot of undercover things to get the nuclear weapons that it had, but he mentions the fact that just like having a stealth lobby in the United States, having nuclear weapons gives it veto power, and it gives it the ability to say to the United States constantly, look, you know, we really don't want to have to unleash these weapons, but I tell you, Iraq's giving us a lot of problems, Egypt is giving us a lot of problems. So basically having nuclear weapons gives Israel more leverage over the United States, although ostensibly we're not the target, or hopefully we're not the target.
Well, sometimes I wonder about that. You know, I guess during the Cold War, the Russians had smuggled some suitcase nukes into American cities, and sometimes I wonder if the Israelis might not try something like that just to make sure that the U.S. government dances to their tune.
Well, they've done false flag operations against the United States. One thing you'll never see a movie on is their terrorist bombing attacks in Egypt designed to get the British and the U.S. to stay there and keep the canal as a neutral zone.
The Levant affair.
That was the Levant affair, or more precisely the Operation Susanna, which is what the Israeli planners called it. But in the Samson option, I'm sorry, it wasn't the Solomon option, Israel's nuclear arsenal and American foreign policy, Hirsch goes in depth into this, and I think the fact, you know, you can talk about suitcase bombs and other, you know, tactical positionings of nuclear weapons, but the fact that there really is this hammer over the United States' head, which is if we don't use our own resources, military might, financial and political influence, to follow policy mandates from Israel, you know, again, they can always say that, hey, we might be forced to actually use these. So that's probably one of the most important developments on a regional level since the whole, you know, concept of mutually assured destruction back in the Cold War, the fact that a smaller country has effective veto power over the military actions of a larger country and can even motivate it to some extent by possessing nuclear weapons and the threat that it might use them against conventional foes.
And then that strikes me as a little odd. The Russians have a whole lot more nuclear weapons than the Israelis do, and yet they don't have complete veto power over everything the U.S. does. But anyway, the world of, you know, Israeli influence in the U.S. doesn't really make logical sense. We do have more callers, so let's bring them on. Byron from Canada. How are you, Byron?
Been great show again as usual. I missed the first part of it, so I hope I'll be in line with what you got to talk about. I heard earlier something about money that was being used to kind of persuade politicians. Did you ever check to see any of the aid that we give Israel? Has that ever been brought back into the United States to use, you know, for political contributions? And the other question I want to ask you is, you were talking about, I think, about getting into the archives, opening the archives. This administration that we have now, or I should say what you guys have now, where they've destroyed so many emails and tapes and whatever, how do you know that they're not destroying a lot of the stuff that's going on now that in future, future times when they want to open up the archives, that a lot of the stuff that they're doing now, the illegal stuff that they're doing now, won't be destroyed? I'll hang up and I'll listen to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Byron.
Okay, well, yeah, I think we should take the second question first. Well, we already know a lot of it has been erased. You know, the RNC is not complying with any requests to restore administration emails covering a critical period when major figures were funneling all of their really private communications through the domain of the RNC. So we already know that that's happening beyond the fact that electronic records open up a whole new challenge for archiving.
Indeed, and especially when we have the kind of attitudes that we currently have at the highest levels of power. We'll be back in a few moments here at Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, and I'm talking with Grant Smith, the author of Foreign Agents. We'll be right back. And, Grant, we were just talking about the two topics of the viability or the integrity of archives. And then also the question of recycling money. When you look at the early 60s, when Proto APAC had just been launched with Israeli money, that seed money looks like it really paid off for the Israelis in the long run, didn't it?
It did. And, you know, it didn't have to be huge amounts, but it was key for jump-starting fundraising. It was key for jump-starting efforts on Capitol Hill, and then it kind of snowballed from there. You know, there are donors right now to this particular organization who are overseas, but by all indications, the majority of their money is from the United States, and there are certainly many eager donors now who are putting their money down to APAC as it, you know, breaks the $50 million and $75 million fundraising mark. I don't have any particular information on recent egregious examples where the exact same U.S. aid that went overseas came back to lobby. But, you know, money's a fungible thing. And if somebody like a Douglas Faith or a Richard Perle is working on lobbying and all sorts of projects on behalf of Israeli defense contractors, they're simultaneously embedded in our government, I don't know that you actually have to establish a dollar trail for these fungible assets. You can kind of say, hey, you know, is this the way we really want to make policy in our government?
Right. Well, the statistics I've seen suggest that the U.S. taxpayer has directly handed over $100 billion or somewhere in that neighborhood. And the indirect cost, if you add it all up, oil shocks and everything else, you get into, you know, well over a trillion in terms of the...
Yeah, it's a phenomenal amount of resources. And the challenge is what not to include. Do you actually include funds raised by nonprofits across the United States and sent to the country? Do you count debts canceled? Do you count the oil shocks, which were partially triggered by, you know, some of the lobbying by these groups? You know, what do you not count?
Right. If you count it all up, it does add up in you know, over a trillion, which is really a pretty astounding amount of money. Yeah. So, Grant, a couple other things I wanted to ask you about was, let's see, you, in your in the foreign agents book, you talk a little bit about the Franklin affair, and that's
right.
kind of what you take everything up to, and that is, you know, the scandal, the spy scandal that broke out that you thought actually had the potential to take down APAC and didn't quite happen. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Right. Well, basically, the sketch of the trial is that Colonel Lawrence Franklin, who was in Doug Feith's office, was passing information to two high-level APAC lobbyists, Rosen and Weissman, and they were ultimately indicted under the 1917 Espionage Act for receiving classified or information, national defense information, and that could be used to the detriment of the U.S. or passed on to others. And this trial, you know, has not occurred yet. It's scheduled for April 29. But we thought originally if they'd continued, in fact, we even put out a press release, we're the only organization who did this, congratulating the indictment, saying, well, is this... does this mean that you're going to follow up and take it all the way through the Department of Defense and, you know, the Office of Special Plans? And, of course, it wasn't. And although Colonel Franklin was sentenced to 12 years in prison, he won't actually go to prison until after the trial of the APAC lobbyists, which begs the question of whether he'll actually go at all. The latest development on the trial is that the top prosecutor has recently resigned to pursue employment in the private sector at a major firm, leaving Hammerstrom, the only other person whose name is on the indictment, to take the case forward. We had speculated in the book that something like this might happen, where the prosecution could simply give up. The Wall Street Journal called on Michael Mukasey, the new attorney general, to shut this trial down because it was such a travesty in their eyes. You know, how could these lobbyists be accused of doing this? And so at this point, the trial looks to be in jeopardy, and there are certainly about five other ways that this trial could simply disappear. But either way, it doesn't look as though it's going to have the impact on APAC that it probably could and should have had. But APAC has a history There have been cases that have gone to the Supreme Court about their electioneer violations, which resulted in no charges. There's a history of engineering with classified information. The free trade agreement, the FBI found they had classified information they shouldn't have had, and nothing happened. So if you're a betting man, the odds are that it'll escape any sort of legal, justified legal attention for this latest scandal.
You talk about Douglas Faith, who is named by Sybil Edmonds, I believe,
right,
along with Richard Pearl, as one of the two American names. If that enters public consciousness, it's going to be a big deal, isn't it?
Well, look how hard it's fought to get out into the public. Apparently, this FBI translator has a lot of goods on high administration officials, a lot of whom are linked with AIPAC. Now, she's been trying to get her story out. Henry Waxman had promised that as soon as the Democrats took over Congress, they'd have hearings on it, but he's chosen to focus on baseball instead. You know, I think this kind of just circles back to the fact that we can't ever seem to get our arms around current history. The information that's classified, or someone's being shut up like Sybil Edmonds is with a state secrets gag order, allows a lot of this corruption to go on by delaying the release of relevant information that any American would want to make decisions, particularly in the voting booth, delaying it until it no longer matters. And that's precisely what we see happening with her case.
This is Kevin Barrett talking with Grant Smith, the author of Foreign Agents, and he's with the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, which is IRMEP.org. I will have some other guests talking about related subjects in the near future on Monday on An Evil Rival Network. I'll be talking with Anne Chamberlain, author of A History of Women's Seclusion in the Middle East. The Veil and the Looking Glass is the title. The subtitle is A History of Women's Seclusion in the Middle East. Anne Chamberlain is a feminist who argues that veiling and seclusion are feminist strategies for empowerment and always have been. Another kind of argument you don't hear much in the mainstream media. And future guests include David Griffin, the 9/11 truth icon, Mikey Weinstein of MilitaryReligiousFreedom.org, Lynn Margulis, one of the planet's leading scientists, and former Governor Jesse Ventura. So check out the schedule at the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth. That's MUJCA.com. Grant, I guess maybe the best way to end this would be to discuss where you see things going from here and how people can get involved to help help restore some balance in U.S. Mideast policy.
Well, I think the beginning, of course, is looking for the hard truths, and I think that's what we've been circling back to all evening, is people who want something other than the fully varnished spiel that they're getting on the mainstream corporate media can certainly look for truth and find quite a bit of it. It's out there. It's always been out there, and it's always been accessible in part to people who are actually looking for it. So I think, you know, absent the transformative experience that someone like Yvonne had in actually seeing what was really going on as opposed to what she was being told, I think people can actually begin to get more information about how government is supposed to work, how policy is supposed to be formed. Think about the stake they have in this, whether they have children who might be shipped off to war or whether they see what's been happening to the economy as a result of these policies, and begin to lay down an implicit threat to their government, which is that if you continue to ignore justice, if you continue to ignore the laws, if you continue to ignore the principles upon which our country was founded in your particular government, you better not long expect the obedience of the populace. And I think education and speaking out, again, as many of your callers seem to be doing, is truly the answer.
And what's the best way to deliver the message? Do you think maybe calling into mainstream radio is one way? They can't really censor you when you do that the way they can when you write a letter to the editor.
No, that's a great strategy. I think live media, for anyone who's got an alternative message, being live is critical. Otherwise, you're simply edited out. But you're certainly building an alternative media. I've been surprised, frankly, at the world of podcasting and how much information and new thinking there is out there. So I think people need to keep building the online information movement and then take action based on their findings.
And that's what we're doing right here at Truth Jihad Radio. Well, hey, thank you so much, Grant Smith. It's been a very enlightening conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Barrett. It's been great.
Okay, take care.
Bye now.
Bye. That was Grant Smith. He's the author of Foreign Agent, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal, and also Deadly Dogma about the neoconservatives. Well, hey, thanks for listening, and we'll be back again, same time, same channel next week, right here on RepublicBroadcasting.org. Till then, have a good one.